Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. On June 16th, 2020, Indian and Chinese forces clashed high in the Himalayan mountains in Aksai Chin. Beijing and New Delhi both claim control over this remote region in a territorial dispute dating back decades. Sources differ on how many soldiers died in the skirmish, fought with fists and clubs rather than guns, with the potential death toll ranging into the dozens. Looking back 2 years later, the skirmish at Galwan marked a clear turning point in relations between these two Asian countries, with India now taking a much harsher line towards China, joining the US, Australia, and Japan in the so-called Quad Alliance, banning Chinese-affiliated apps like Alibaba and TikTok. Why has the border between China and India been disputed for so long? And what made the bloody clash at Galwan a watershed for New Delhi's view of China? Manoj Joshi, in his book for Hearst earlier this year, Understanding the India-China Border, the Enduring Threat of War in High Himalaya, explains where this dispute came from, how it sometimes led to war, and the many failed attempts to find a negotiated solution. Manoj Joshi is a distinguished fellow at the Observer Research Foundation. He has been a journalist specializing on national and international politics and is a commentator and columnist on these issues. As a reporter, he has written extensively on issues relating to Siachen, Pakistan, China, Sri Lanka, and terrorism in Kashmir and Punjab. Today, Manoj and I talk about the border dispute, where it came from, and why both countries have been unable to reach a negotiated solution. So, Manoj, thank you so much for joining me today on the Asian Review of Books podcast. I want to start with kind of the incident that brought the India-China border into the news, at least in recent years, which was the skirmish at Galwan. And maybe I just want to ask kind of what actually happened there to the best of our knowledge.
Well, April, May 2020, the Chinese suddenly occupied certain what are called unheld areas, meaning there's a line of actual control which is 4,000 kilometers long and it can't be policed. You can't police every inch of it, meaning you patrol there and you come back. So there are certain areas where there is an overlap of claims. I say that the border is at the far end of the room. The Chinese say that the border is at the near end of the room. So in between, in the room, both sides patrol. But the peculiarity about Galwan is that there was no doubt about where the line of actual control lay. And yet the Chinese, amongst the five places they intruded into, Galwan was one of them. And surprisingly enough, on 6th of June, there was actually high-level talks, you know, at the level of lieutenant generals near the Pangong Lake. And a withdrawal was agreed on. Both sides agreed. And then when the Indian team went to the Chinese, where the Chinese had occupied in the territory in Galwan, when it went there, it found that the Chinese were still there. And they had a post and they hadn't pulled back. Well, actually, what happened was initially they pulled back, but when the reports came that they had come back to that area. So this Colonel Babu, his name was Babu, Santosh Babu, he and his team landed up there to talk to the Chinese. And while that conversation was going on, a fracas developed. Now, this is a high altitude area with a fast flowing, very cold stream, meaning even in summer, it's very, very cold. And so the skirmish went on from at least I should say, sundown up to midnight. So both sides reinforced their positions. But and strangely enough, this was using fists and stones and clubs. Though, from whatever evidence I have, the Indian side at least had guns. The guns were not used. So, but when the dust cleared, we found that 20 Indians had died, including Colonel Babu. And some people say that at least 17 of them died because of hypothermia, meaning the cold, meaning they were injured, but then they didn't get treatment and they died. In the case of the Chinese, almost 6 months later, they acknowledged that four people had died. Many people speculate that more may have been killed. And the Chinese also took a number of prisoners. They released them 3 days later. And then the senior officers came, and I think they everything sort of calmed down out there. And in July, at the end of July, both sides agreed to separate their forces by 1.5 kilometers each. And that's the position as it exists till now.
So I'd like to take a big step back and, you know, ask what makes this part of the world, what makes this border, you know, quote unquote, important? You know, why does, what makes it important for India and what makes it important for China? You know, these are remote areas of the Himalayas. They're very high up. So why do, in theory, why do both governments care about this region?
Well, for the Chinese, actually, for the Indians, it is more a question of, sovereign territory and things like that. For the Chinese, there is a strategic reason. They have a highway going from Xinjiang to Tibet, which goes through this region, a place called Aksaichin, which is to the east of where this incident occurred. And the Chinese always obsess that India can use, because the terrain is such, north of that, the terrain is such, it's pretty flat and you can even use tanks there. The Chinese constantly worry that Indians would interdict their highway. So they've kept on pushing the border westwards, you see, basically to provide security for their key highway. As far as the Indians are concerned, the way they look at it is that this is very important for the defense of their main town in Ladakh, which is called Leh, as well as for another reason that if you go beyond that, you come to what is called the Siachen Glacier, where India and China, India and Pakistan have been fighting for years and years. And what the Indians worry is that if the Chinese keep on pushing westwards, they will link up with the Pakistanis, and so the huge chunk of northern territory will be lost, and India's Ladakh Union Territory will be endangered.
So, you know, why is this border contested at all? Kind of, what's the original historical disagreement that leads this border to be disputed? You know,
well, you see, when India became free in 1947. The maps of India actually didn't show any border, meaning it showed blank. It was just marked by a color flat wash, you know, but there was no line. So it is neither demarcated nor delineated. Insofar as China is concerned, you see, the Chinese occupied Tibet in 1951. Prior to that, there was no real Chinese control of the border. So India and Tibet, because had a kind of a relationship where there was, you know, customary, both sides had some notion of the border, but there was no hard and fast kind of rule. So there were specific villages and towns where you identified where the Tibetan officials would operate from, and there were places where Indians would operate from, but there was no kind of fixed thing that from that mountain to that mountain is mine, and the other side is yours. But when the Chinese came, they came with the idea of setting up a national sovereign people's republic. And so did India. So this modern concept of the border, earlier border was kind of a zone. In the old days, borders were zones where you went from one zone to the other, and where exactly you cross the border was not very clear. So these two republics kind of tried, wanted their sovereign borders demarcated. And the problem was that Indians handled it badly. Right from the outset, the Indians said that there's a customary and traditional border, and we know where it is, so there's no need to negotiate. And the Chinese tried to, because the Chinese were occupying what India said was its territory. The Chinese, this area of Aksai Chin, where all these things have been happening, is a very remote area. It's even for a mountain area, it was extraordinarily remote. And there's nothing there. There are no resources there. There's not even pasturages, you know. And it was a kind of a huge no man's land. But as I explained to you, the Chinese needed it from the strategic point of view. So they intruded into it. So this, essentially, if you want to put it another way, they occupied the no man's land. But India also had claims on that no man's land, you see. And so that is where the kind of dispute began to arise, because they were unable to negotiate a border. Because normally what you would do is that the two sides would sit together, set up survey teams, and get their maps and all that out, and then negotiate, meaning give and take, and delineate a border first on maps, then put it down on the ground, and maybe put boundary markers and things like that. But none of that happened. At the political negotiation phase itself, things collapsed. Prime Minister Nehru refused to accept that there was any dispute. Prime Minister Zhou Enlai of China came to India in April of 1960, hoping to sell a compromise solution, but the Indian side rejected it. So that is how that dispute kind of went haywire. And then in 1962, there was a war, which further poisoned the relationship. So the border has remained disputed since. Since then, it is marked by a line of actual control, which means nothing. Meaning it's a line of actual control means you are where you are, I am where I am. But there is no common line of actual control. There's no common map between the India and China. So there are large areas of overlap. There are 17, 18 places where even the line of actual control overlaps, leave alone the larger issue of the dispute of the border.
And quickly, just to kind of, because there's the line of actual control between India and China, and then there's the line of control between India and Pakistan and Kashmir. I mean, is the line of control between India and Pakistan, is that even more formal than the line of actual control between India and China?
Absolutely. Meaning the line of control with Pakistan is in Kashmir. Okay. And this was essentially the ceasefire line in 1949. And then it became the line of control in 1972 after the Bangladesh War. Now, the point is, this line was meticulously surveyed by surveyors of both sides. They surveyed it, prepared a mosaic of maps. Both sides signed them. Each point, each river, each nala, stream, etc., is identified. So the line of control is identified in a modern cartographical process. That's the difference. Whereas the line of actual control, in many ways, is notional, meaning it's where you say it is.
So, I mean, so obviously the nadir of this is the 1962 war, but it seems like the extent to which India and China are willing to talk about the border, that changes in the decades since. The extent to which either country cares about this border dispute changes in the decades since. How has each country's position on the border changed since 1962? It seems like at times they're more willing to talk about it, then at other times they backtrack on what they perhaps agreed to do earlier. How have these discussions changed since 62?
See, from 62 till 1980, there was no talk between them. In 1980, they began to kind of talk. They had several rounds of talks between each other. In 1987, there was another crisis when the in the east this time, and near the town, north of the town of Tawang, and where both sides mobilized their armies right across the border. Now, this was the time, if you recollect, Chinese were trying to calm down things. They were trying to start their liberalization and didn't want to get involved in crises. So by 1993, the two sides, after talks, agreed to kind of work out a mechanism to maintain peace and tranquility on the border. The important part of that was that India, for the first time, recognized the concept of the line of actual control. Till then, India had not recognized that concept. India had been absolutely... See, and just a little bit of... in the 1980s, the Chinese once again proposed a swap. In 1960, when Zhou Enlai had come to Delhi, he had said, look, why don't we swap? We will concede your eastern claims. You concede our western claims. And as I said, Indians rejected it. Now, in 1980s, late 1970s, Deng Xiaoping again raised this. Early 80s, again, the Chinese proposed it, and again, the Indians rejected it. And in 1985, the Chinese positions hardened. I think they realized that, look, in the West, we already have what we need. So why do we give any concessions to the Indians in the East? So they started saying that earlier they were ready to agree with the Eastern border as it existed. Now they started saying that actually a bigger dispute lies here. There's a bigger dispute in the East than in the West. And as I told you, in the West, they were already occupying what they needed to occupy. So that is the way the dispute twisted out there. But then, as I said, the 93 agreement was there to maintain peace and tranquility. And a critical part of the agreement, the crucial part, the agreement revolved around determining where the line of actual control lay. Because if you're going to maintain peace and tranquility along the line of actual control, you should know where it is. It should be agreeable to both sides. Now, strangely enough, in all these years, we have not even been able to achieve that. We have not been able to fulfill that agreement where all the places, as I noted, told you, 17, 18 places where there are overlapping claims, we could have sat down with surveyors and said, okay, let's determine what is where here, and let's get a common line of actual control. Because that would make it beyond these kind of incursions and things like that. But the Chinese... did not bite that. They have refused to do that.
You mentioned in your answer kind of this land swap proposal. You know that basically said recognize China's claims in the West, recognize India's claims in the East, and leave it at that. And I know that that's been a solution, quote unquote, that's been proposed several times throughout the decade since. I think mostly by China. But what stopped that? What stopped just formalizing the status quo from becoming the solution to this conflict?
You know, that's not easy to determine, because in 2005 we actually signed an agreement on the political parameters and agreed guidelines of a border settlement. And if you read that particular agreement, it would seem. Because it said that when determining the border, both sides will take into account each other's strategic concerns. Now, as I told you, that the strategic concern really pertained to Aksai Chin for China. And another clause of the agreement says that in arriving at a border settlement, we will take into account the settled populations. Now, that would be the East. In the East, India has settled populations. There are no settled populations in the West. So to me, the agreement sounded as though they were formalizing the swap. But then the Chinese walked back on that as well. And I think that the Chinese, by 2008, 2009, you know, because of the global financial crisis and because of China's phenomenal growth, whereas in 1990, India and China were roughly equal in terms of GDP. By 2010, China was somewhere else and India had been left far behind. And 1990, China was ready to deal with India as an equal. But in 2010, it began to feel, why should we deal with this guy as equals? You know? And I think they have found it convenient not to settle the border so that they can keep India off balance.
So I want to ask a question about you. I mean, you've worked as a journalist throughout a lot of this period, and you've had the maybe good fortune, maybe you can call it that, to actually meet, interview, work with a lot of the key players, at least in India, but I think also in China, throughout these negotiations, throughout these disputes. In your mind, kind of, who were some of the kind of key individual players in this, and kind of what was your impression of how they were thinking about China and this border dispute?
Well, you know, in the first phase, Prime Minister Nehru himself, meaning it was between him and Prime Minister Zhou Enlai. The dispute played out in their correspondence. Subsequently, officials came into the picture. From the Indian side, it was a gentleman called Parthasarathy, you know, G. Parthasarathy. He was a very influential figure in the government and also advised the government on foreign policy. And Parthasarathy was an old Nehru loyalist. So in the 80s, when the Chinese came up with a compromise proposal, Parthasarathy turned it down. He didn't agree with it. And of course, subsequently, the thing became more formalized as talks between officials of the two sides, which were kind of, you know, in the 1980s, there was not much to go by. Then, as I said, the 87 crisis took place. And in 1988, for the first time an Indian Prime Minister visited China. That was in 1988, Rajiv Gandhi went to China. And subsequent to that, that Border Peace and Tranquility Agreement was signed. Now, all this, yes, politically, Rajiv Gandhi took the bit between his teeth and decided to visit China. And basically, as I said, the messaging was similar, meaning he met Deng Xiaoping, and Deng Xiaoping made that famous statement that, you know, we cannot have an Asian century unless India and China have friendship between them. And so this was the mood where both countries were trying to create, liberalize, work with their economies. They were looking for some peaceful ways. So basically, they decided on the 93 agreement that at least there should be some form of peace and tranquility along the LAC. And after that, of course, there have been, again, as I said, most of it had been subsequently arisen from talks between officials. But then in 2002, Prime Minister Vajpayee went to China and he proposed to them that why don't we settle this, forget all old maps and old claims and things like that. Let's arrive at a political settlement. So for that settlement, two very senior officers, meaning Prime Minister's own secretary, political secretary, Mr. Brijesh Mishra from the Indian side, and the Chinese very senior officer Dai Bingguo, they became special representatives. And so this thing now is managed by special representative. But Brijesh Mishra himself told me after retirement that they had hoped to actually settle everything within 2 or 3 years. But that didn't happen because Vajpayee's government lost power in 2004. And the special representative talks have been continuing. Now, according to my friend Shivshankar Menon, who was also a special representative, the officials have done their job. They've worked out everything. Basically, the final framework can only be done if there is political agreement, if the politicians agree, you know, and if the politicians agree, things can quickly fall in place. But I don't think the politicians are ready for that. China has its own calculations. India has its own. And so we've had no political meeting of views as far as the border settlement is concerned.
So I want to return to the return to the present day, as it were. You know, kind of looking back since Galwan, to me, the skirmish at Galwan appears to me to have been a real turning point in India-China relations. I think especially in India, where that seems to have sparked a much greater, you could say, attention, campaign, controls on Chinese on China's presence in India. I remember the government banned a lot of Chinese apps like TikTok, also even just Chinese affiliated apps from, you know, come from companies that had Chinese investment, like I think like apps from C. There's obviously a much greater attention paid now to accusations of tax evasion against Chinese phone manufacturers. There was, I think just last week, just over the weekend from when we were recording this conversation, there was a story about them raiding Paytm and a few other, sorry, not raiding, but investigating with Indian payment processors regarding a Chinese loan app that was being accused of fleecing its customers. So I guess, so it really seems to have been a sharp turn in India's attitude towards China and towards China's presence in India. I guess, what was it about Galwan that maybe helped to spark the shift? And then where do you see kind of India's China policy going from here?
Well, you see, the reason why Galwan was a shift, I explained to you that from 1993, we started creating a confidence-building measures regime. So we had agreement after agreement. We have 93 agreement, we have a 96 agreement. The 93 and 96 agreements even spoke of thinning down forces in the line along the line of actual control, removing certain kinds of heavy weaponry, etc. So it is pretty detailed. Then, as I explained to you, we were trying to work out a common line of actual control as per those agreements. But by 2001 and 2002, it was clear that the Chinese were, that was unacceptable to China. They didn't want to fix the line of actual control. In 2002 itself, the special representatives were appointed, you know, for the process. Then 2005, we had this political parameters, agreed guidelines of a border settlement, which looked like, you know, things were going right. And simultaneously, we also had military CBMs, the military to military CBMs. How will the militaries behave when they meet each other in the border? You know, and it is a fairly detailed process. And amongst them was the clause that they will not use arms. And that is what happened in Galwan. The Indians didn't use their weapons. Now, so this confidence building measures regime, 2012, we had another one, Border Defense Cooperation Agreement. So the way the Indians saw it is that in Galwan, this entire confidence building regime concept went for a toss. Because the Chinese, by massing troops without informing India, by occupying, blockading, establishing blockades against India in five different places in Ladakh, the Chinese had essentially destroyed the confidence building measures regime. And the clash itself, because as it is famously said, there's not a single bullet had been fired since 1975. And in Galwan, suddenly 24, meaning if you count the Chinese claim of four, 24 people died, hundreds were injured. There was an actual clash. See? So the point was the destruction of that confidence-building measures regime took place because of Galwan. And so it is a turning point. What you've lost really is trust. Because you can have that kind of a confidence-building regime if you trust each other. Trust was building up. And it's remarkable because in 2018, after the crisis, there was a small crisis in Doklam in Bhutan. India and China were involved. After that crisis, we began the process of informal summits, meaning Prime Minister Modi, General Secretary and President Xi Jinping had an informal summit in Wuhan where they talked without agendas for 2 days in 2018. And in 2019, October, there was another informal summit in Chennai, in India. So when you look at it, it seemed that everything was stabilizing by the end of 2019. And then suddenly in 2020, we had that this Chinese action where they mass their armies, where they occupy places along the line of actual control, block Indian patrolling. So what I'm trying to get at is that Galwan, in that sense, the key point is the loss of trust. And now the Indians are actually allowed to, the Indian forces are allowed to shoot back, for one thing. So it's this lack of trust which has created this situation. And India is very clear. You see, unless and until there's a status quo ante, you must go back to April of 2020 in terms of where your troops are located. We can't even begin to move forward. But I think, to be frank, I don't think there's any going back. You have to keep on going forward as far as this is concerned. So there is an element of distrust. I think both sides will have to now think how to maintain peace and tranquility along the border. That is the big issue that confronts them, because both sides are also building up. The Chinese are building up for their Tibetan defenses, and the Indians are building up their defenses. So the thing has become more hazardous.
So I think with that, that ends our interview with Manoj Joshi, author of Understanding the India-China Border, The Enduring Threat of War in High Himalaya. Manoj, I actually have two final questions for you, which is, where can people find your work, and what's next for you? What's your next project?
Well, people can find my work. I think Amazon has it on them, and I've seen they even have electronic version already. It was published in London in July by Seahurst, and it has just come out this month in India, published by HarperCollins. So there's an Indian edition published by HarperCollins, and I would say the British edition is really the global edition, which is published by Seahurst, but they're identical in every way, except for a quirky thing in the title, where the British edition, where the British edition says the enduring threat of war in High Himalaya, but the Indian edition says the enduring threat of war in the High Himalayas. So I checked with the Brits. They didn't bother to answer. So I said, oh, how can I challenge them on grammar? So I think some problem there. but the Indian one has a different title. As to where I go from there, you know, as I said, my background is as a journalist. I worked. I was covering this Chinese thing right from the 1980s. The second thing that I was covering was terrorism. And I think India doesn't have a comprehensive account of how terrorism affected India and how it dealt with it. So I'm going to work on that now.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about it. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many other author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. This podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Hannah Kirshner, author of Water, Wood, and Wild Things, Learning Craft and Cultivation in a Japanese Mountain Town. But before then, Manoj, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Nicholas, for doing this podcast and putting out the word with regard to my book.